people in need.
Israel has now pushed the Palestinian population in Gaza to the brink of famine, with international agencies warning that the risk of famine is real, World Food Program, and that it is increasing each day. Most of the Palestinian people in Gaza are now starving, with levels of starvation rising daily. The World Health Organization warns that hunger is ravaging Gaza.
As the United Nations Secretary General has stated, 4 out of 5 of the hungriest people anywhere in the world are in Gaza. With Palestinians in Gaza facing the highest levels of acute food insecurity ever classified by the IPC. UNRWA's Commissioner General describes, quote, desperate, hungry, and terrified people who are now stopping aid trucks, taking the food, and eating it right away, close quotes. The World Health Organization has stated that, quote, an unprecedented 93% of the population in Gaza is facing crisis levels of hunger, with insufficient food and high levels of malnutrition.
The conditions created by the siege are exacerbated by Israel's continuing strikes on Gaza, including on its bakeries, water facilities, and last remaining operating mill, and its raising of agricultural lands, crops, orchards, and greenhouses. By 16th of November 2023, the food infrastructure in Gaza was already considered no longer functional, given shop and market closures, the lack of essential food items, and the inflated price of the scarce food available. Bread is scarce or non-existent, with food scarcity leading to significant price hikes, and the price of flour increasing by 65% at one stage. Livestock that has not been killed is facing starvation, and crops are damaged or destroyed. Many Palestinians are resorting to foraging due to hunger.
And that is the last part of our presentation today, discussing the deprivation of food to Palestinians in Gaza as part of South Africa's charge of genocide against Israel at the International Court in The Hague. These are, of course, charges. Just as in any kind of court case, they represent allegations against Israel, and Israel has its own defense, and they remain to be proven in court. One of the things the South Africa is hoping is that they can get an interim order requiring Israel to stop its operations in Gaza. But that would be kind of the equivalent of like a preliminary injunction, not a final ruling on the question at hand. Israel, of course, has its own defense, and the details of the course of the case will, according to news reports, go on for years, probably long after the operations in Gaza or even the continued presence of Israeli forces in Gaza have gone by. But it's a pretty significant case. And anyway, I hope you found that interesting. Peter Haskell is here with me in the studio. It's quite a mess, this whole situation.
Well, the thing that I thought hearing a bit of it was the children who were made to line up and all that. I don't see what that sort of what was causing to happen positively. We were talking a bit about it while we were hearing it, and one of the things that you were saying to me was that in many ways, from the what they're doing, Israel's doing, that Hamas is just going to survive anyway. Like they're not, there's no way of really taking them away, you were telling me.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my expectation of what will happen when this is all over. I mean, you know, I don't know the situation on the ground, and obviously Israel is going in there and, you know, trying to scour rather thoroughly for, you know, any presence of Hamas fighters and infrastructure and armaments and the rest of it.
Well, but you're saying that you don't think they'll be successful at all?
Well, I don't think so entirely. I mean, you know, the nature of an organization like Hamas is that, you know, it's a bit different than, you know, a traditional uniformed army, which, you know, when there becomes a point where they can just melt away into the population, right? And a lot of them will do that. And a lot of Hamas leadership isn't even in Gaza. It's, you know, it's in other places.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, like apparently the main leader of Hamas is in one of the Gulf states. I can't remember off the top.
Why don't they go there? I don't know. I'll try to find them.
I guess that would be a whole new can of worms for
Israel. I don't mean to attack the Gulf states, but just try to find where the hotel he's staying. But so a real peacenik thing was they shouldn't do anything, not because they weren't attacked or that something wrong had happened, but it wasn't going to really cause anything positive at the end to happen. Limited response, more limited than what they did is what was actually called for.
Definitely, perhaps. You know, I mean, just getting back to the previous point, you know, Israel invaded and occupied Gaza. They took it over in 1967 as part of the 67 war, and they were occupied it until the early 2000s, and then the Israelis withdrew from Gaza entirely. There were even settlements and stuff there at the time, just as there are in the West Bank. And under the Ariel Sharon government, they withdrew entirely, and they dismantled the settlements, etc. And then later on, you know, Hamas seized control of it. So Hamas controlled Gaza. The other, I think the Fatah faction of the PLO controlled the West Bank and still does. And in response to previous attacks, probably rocket attacks, I think it was, you know, in 2009, Israel invaded and occupied the Gaza Strip for a shorter period of time. The whole war lasted about 22 days, and then they withdrew, and Hamas just popped back into control. I mean, obviously, you know, based on that experience, with their goals in mind, they're doing what they would see as a more thorough job. But it's still, you know, of attacking and rooting out Hamas. They've been there 3 months instead of 3 weeks. But I don't know necessarily that they'll be a whole lot more successful. Obviously, they're gonna have attacked and destroyed Hamas resources and infrastructure and stuff a lot more with this. But that doesn't mean Hamas is going to go away.
I would say, unfortunately, it seems like it's not to do anything would have been the best one. Which, from an emotional standpoint, for a lot of the Israeli population, would have been kind of hard to do, in a sense. But one thing is that I think you can go the other way of being too critical what Israel is doing. There's sort of a reason why they're doing it as such. But I think they are going overboard, which, I mean, they're sort of stuck in a tough place to a way. But one thing that I've been against over the years is that Israel has an actual draft. In fact, you can't even have the option of saying, oh, I want to go. I want to leave the country. They say, no, you'll leave the country once you have done your service. And what some people have done is that before the person is 18, they'll leave the country or something like this. Now, I think my position was that this should end, but the draft should end. Or at least, you know, they say if what was the expression, love it or leave it. So they didn't have the option of leaving it.
Yeah.
So I guess this one has a bit of defense for a draft now, but not really. That's what my position is on it. They should end the military draft over in Israel.
Of course, the military draft represents a substantial part of their military strength because they have those kind of their ability to bring up a large number of forces in a short period of time because everybody goes through the military training. So everybody is trained to be a soldier. So when they need soldiers, they just call people up. They don't have
well,
to that,
Well, that's right. But you're just saying the operation now is not going to be effective. So anyway, I'm not overtly critical of Israel, what they're doing, but I guess ultimately I say they should have. Some response, but definitely a low percentage of what they're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question because, you know, if Israel had never, if Israel had responded to, had done nothing, I don't mean nothing, but if they'd done no sort of military response, you know, the narrative of the whole event would be the Hamas outrage, right? And everybody's, you know, shock and horror at that, which was a terrible, terrible event. I mean, you know, they went in there and killed 1,200 civilians in one night, which is, you know, quite a horrific event in its own sense. And you know, if Israel had not responded in that at that point, that would have been the narrative, Israel's outrage or Hamas's outrage. But I guess, you know, there's, from a political point of view, there's no way they could just sit and do nothing any more than the United States could have done nothing in response to, for instance, 9/11 or any other number of things. There's always like, well, we got to do something. We got to at least bomb some people or something.
Well, then you could have said they shouldn't have had the second Iraqi war, which I think is true. They shouldn't have gone there.
True.
So, I mean, anyway, that's the peacenik view, which is mine. Ultimately,
you know, the flip side, of course, to that is that, you know, if you don't do anything, then, the narrative or the argument is that, well, they're just going to do it again because there's no price to be paid. But it's, you know, it's an interesting back and forth that ends up happening, right?
Well, you know, that's right.
We hit you, you hit us, we hit you back again, you hit us, you know, and I have to admit, you know, when this first happened, you know, back in October, you know, my initial reaction was, oh, here we go again. There's going to be like, this happens, Israel's going to retaliate, you know, Palestinians will feel angry and injured, and they'll be gearing up for the next time they can strike back, and it just goes back and forth and back and forth. You know, how do you get around it? I mean, it's not an issue we can get into, but you know, you kind of had the same kind of dynamic happening with, you know, the struggles in Northern Ireland, you know, restrike. And eventually they solved it. There is ways, but this has proven to be a particularly difficult one. Any last words before we move on?
Well, I guess one defense Israel has is that, well, by us attacking, they haven't attacked us back again. And the thing is that if they hadn't done anything, they probably would have. But I guess perhaps the right thing would have been a fraction of what they did.
Well, that's very true. All right, thanks. We're going to be back in a couple minutes with Peter's going to talk about
Haiti. And actually, the peacekeepers, how the UN peacekeepers are acting in Haiti from 2004, 2007. They actually left in 2017. But this was a very bad period, and it sort of goes a bit with what we were just talking is about the overextension they were doing at one time.
All right, we'll be back in a couple of minutes. This is The Hallucination with Tree of Woe featuring Damian Abraham.
It started out as inquiry, but simply put, I no longer needed to know. But this presented a problem. How do I stop you from knowing? How do I stop you from seeing the reality? But then it hit me. What if I make reality? What if I make the reality that is what you want to see? A reality that plays to your fear. We'll be right back.
your face next time we meet. But face to face is where it stops. Never preach on the phone, cause I think it's a cop. Fill the world and hit the stage. Until I fist can't crush you with rage. Just let you think that you've gotten something. To find a way to weaponize nothing. Like nothing done at the time of decision. Nothing's evil as God's mission. Nothing's ever than when a mic's dropped. Won't admit it yourself cause you're in a cop.
The Hallucination and The Tree of Woe featuring Damien Abraham. That is from their new album called The Path of the Heel, new on our playlist here at CJSF. Peter, you're here to talk about the UN peacekeepers.
When they had UN peacekeepers there from 2004 to 2017, but there was a really bad period of about 2005, 2006, where there was 15 raids, and they had helicopters. They also had sort of like those vans where you have like a SWAT kind of thing, yeah. And they would just terrorize the whole townage.
So what was the setup for this? Why were UN peacekeepers in Haiti?
Well, I think I know actually recently in 2021 there was the assassination.
Yeah.
But I think there was in the United States forces went in 1994, didn't they? There was like a political upset and so on.
Yeah, and I think the peacekeepers went in. There's like a failed coup or something like that in Haiti, and
right, and that's sort of what happened.
Yeah,
but what I found it was.
And I remember there was some bit where they chased out the. I don't know. I'm going to look it up. Go ahead.
No, but I guess I was. I saw a documentary that was done in 2018. It Stays Woo Is You, Use of Force of UN peacekeepers in Haiti. And there was a lawyer involved with it. Actually, she, I guess he was involved with the making of the film more than being presented in the documentary. But she had a little podcast where she talks about how hard it was for the people to make a complaint about what happened, to get any information. In fact, the United Nations and the departments made it just impossible to either lodge a complaint because people died, children died, and it's never been reported exactly how many died from this. Because in one raid, there was 10,000 bullets used, and they said the thing about those bullets, they were not of the gang bullet, because that was the reason why. And this is what they have now in Haiti. Now they have the gangs taking over.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that was said was that the business people and so on were sort of asking for it, asking for the raids more than it was perhaps wanted, because they wanted protection of their property and so on.
Right.
And okay. So what happened here was that one of the generals. Oh, this was the other problem with it. They were mainly from Brazil. Was the country that mm-hmm. most of these peacekeepers were from. There was a few other Latin countries also, but in Brazil, it's Portuguese that they speak. And the people in Haiti speak French. So there was no communication between the peacekeepers and the people. They were like the people couldn't really say anything to the peacekeepers. They couldn't understand them. And yeah. when they said something, they couldn't understand it either. And one general resigned, who was the general in charge of the peacekeepers in Haiti. Mm-hmm. Because he thought he was pressured too much what to use force. Then there was another one who became the general, and he was found dead, supposedly of a suicide. And the one that that took his place was under Pinochet in Chile. He was served under Pinochet, so it was not a good situation, mm-hmm. and it never had really. Much opportunity to question what was going on, period. And one thing I'd like to bring up is that Kofi Annan was the Secretary General of the UN up to the end of 2006. And this is sort of a tragedy because a lot of hopes was put on Kofi Annan because he was the first non-white Secretary General mm-hmm. of the UN, and I think he disappointed a lot of people. And actually, I just found out that from 1993 to 1996, he was the Undersecretary General of basically peacekeeping operations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this was not good for him that he was. Involved that the situation under him had been this. Now, one thing about I'm going to get the exact number, but when Hillary Clinton, the thing was before the earthquake, Haiti was in a bad situation. The earthquake happened in 2010.
Yeah.
And when Hillary Clinton was
Secretary of State?
Yes. But she stopped. They wanted to raise the minimum wage in Haiti from about 25 cents to over 60 cents. And Hillary Clinton stopped it, but she blocked that from happening. There was actually problems with the Clinton Foundation sent moldy trailers supposedly to them after the earthquake. And then there's the problem of all the funds, because what happened to all what was donated to Haiti, and so on. Now, the other thing is that the UN peacekeepers in Haiti, which was from, as I said, 2004 to 2017, supposedly cost $12 billion for that operation, which is kind of outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
So
anyway, where did all the money go?
I know. Well, anyway, so, but it's sort of, as we were saying about the Israeli situation, there was a bit of, we can say there was a bit of overkill. There was a bit of overkill in how to deal with the gang situation in Haiti. And now Kenya, they're talking about Kenya maybe having a peacekeepers with that.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole, but I think it was kind of a bad situation at that time. And I don't think it was warranted what had happened during that period.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so. Oh, the other thing I found out was that Joe Biden had said in the mid-1990s, Haiti could disappear and no one would actually notice. He said that as a senator.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the greatest thing of them all. Anyway, so anyway, Magnus, so that's my report.
All right.
I spent some time doing it. I saw a lot of stuff, you know. I just don't get my
notes. Haiti's a complicated story because it seems no matter what happens, the country, it doesn't seem to be able to pull itself together, and there's a lot of talk about why that is. I mean, you know, is it because of internal problems? Is it because of external interference? You know, crushing poverty is not something that is great for social stability either, which seems to be an ongoing issue in Haiti. They definitely talk about it a lot on Democracy Now. I mean, maybe I should dig deeper into it, but it's never been I've never been able to make a whole lot of sense out of the problems in Haiti, just because they seem to be so intractable.
Well, one thing was they freed themselves in 1804.
Mm-hmm.
And France gave them at the time a debt of 115 million francs for basically freeing themselves, which you figure.
Yeah, my understanding is
France should have been giving them money, but but they didn't.
But France demanded compensation for the lost property when the Haitians raised up in a revolution and overthrew French colonial rule. And I guess the French said, well, we're going to come back and take over again unless you give us compensation.
Well, that's what they said.
Yeah, but apparently, you know, it was a huge amount of money which wasn't repaid for like 100+ years. You know, it took Haiti that long to repay the amount.
Well, they shouldn't have been asked to pay anything, but I guess...
No, I would, you know, I would agree. I mean, I guess if Haiti had felt they could have told them to buzz off, they would have, but... Maybe they felt stuck in the situation of they didn't want to be invaded again. We're almost out of time here. We got about 45 seconds left in the program. Any final words on the Haiti?
Well, the United States didn't recognize their independence to 1862. France recognized in 1825, but it took 1862 for the United States to recognize their independence.
Yeah, I can imagine that somehow the fact that the Haitians overthrew slavery as part of their revolution was probably why the U.S. didn't recognize them until 1862, which would have been during the American Civil War, and I'm sure they're recognized by the Union side and not the Confederate side. All right. Thanks for coming in today. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Democracy Now! Will be coming up next. Myself and Peter and Aya will be back next week. Here's Democracy Now!